This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's bring back here a voice we have had on before, Professor Arthur Sear. His title is the A.W. and Mary Margaret Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Science. He's also on the faculty of university in not very far from here at Carthage College, which is located in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He was here in Northwest Indiana earlier this year attending the organization that deals with trade in Northwest Indiana, and we were lucky to have him back on to talk about the problems of the world and how they fit into politics and a little bit of economics as well, too. Professor Sear, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciated talking with you before when I addressed the World Trade Alliance of Northwest Indiana, an important and very serious educational and investment group.
And I know also, too, that you have a soft spot in your heart for Northwest Indiana as well, too, besides the opportunity to talk with the Trade Alliance.
Yes, well, thank you for your very good memory. I had the pleasure and challenge of running the World Trade Center in Chicago for 2 years at the end of the 1990s before coming up to Carthage College. It was a good challenge and a healthy one, and working together, we considerably strengthened the World Trade Center in Chicago, and Mayor Scott King of Gary, Indiana, and his colleagues were extremely important in providing us with crucial early financial support that permitted us to become above water and go on from there.
Okay. Professor, here let's take care of some of the topics in the news that we've heard of lately. Here, North Korea is one of these that seems to remain in the forefront here. How do things shape up as you see it? And you focused in particular about how the economics of the world and politics seem to intertwine a lot, and particularly here in Northwest Indiana.
Yes, well, the relationship between the U.S. and South Korea is extremely important, not only because of their tremendously successful economy and political democracy, but close alliance with the U.S. They were very, very supportive of us, not only, of course, during the Korean War, but also during the Vietnam War. South Korea maintained 50,000 troops in South Vietnam during our long war there, and that means, in terms of combat forces, they had about as many as the U.S., only because they support America.
We also know, too, that one of the other topics that's been in the news lately here is involving Brexit, and in particular the UK wanting to leave the European Union here. And in recent days here, the UK Prime Minister Theresa May has assured people that Ireland will definitely be part of everything that happens in this, regardless of what happens as far as Brexit's concerned. What seems to be the latest that you've seen happen, besides what's happening in the UK and Ireland in particular, involving this charge that the UK is taking on, that they want to be separate of the European Union these days?
Well, by a narrow margin, in a referendum, the people who voted in Britain decided that they did want to leave the European Union. The British have always been very much of two minds and ambiguous about their relationship with the continent, going way back in history, not just since the Second World War and the very important European Union. So they're being in line with their history. My own personal hope is that Theresa May, or whoever might succeed her, she is now underwater politically. She's very weak and taking political hits from all sides. She or her successor, I hope, will have another referendum on the subject. I think they're better off in the European Union. But I also think they and the rest of Europe will survive if, in fact, they do leave, because commerce and investment have become so robust and so integrated internationally, not just in the Atlantic region, that I don't believe the economic impact will be all that great. London will remain, in particular, a central financial global capital, not only for traditional banking, but also innovative finance and the insurance industry as well.
One of the other areas that we watched lately, in particular, has come out here, in particular with what President Trump has had to say, is the Middle East. He's recently come out here speaking about the capital of Israel being Jerusalem, and all of the fallout has come about of that as well, too, from the Palestinians, who have thoughts otherwise. We still are obviously keeping a very close eye on the Middle East and all of the hot spots there, too, and certainly concerns for not only for politics, I'm sure, but for the economy as well, for the United States, too, right?
Yeah. Well, again, there's a military as well as economic dimension. I think it's important for all Americans to support our government and the office of the presidency. I do believe that, bluntly, a saving grace of President Trump is that he's in touch with the people in the world constantly, which is certainly his privilege. He doesn't actually do much as president. This is something that he has done, moving the embassy. I do believe it's a mistake, but I believe that I don't believe it's the end of the world or even the end of the Middle East. And I think when we do have a very effective U.S. president leading our foreign policy, and I would certainly put Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon and Carter and George H.W. Bush in those categories, they all made great progress in the Middle East long term. And I'm quite confident we will have a president down the road. Certainly hope President Trump evolves into that kind of leader, but the U.S. will continue to play a positive role. I think it's a mistake to move the embassy, but it's certainly understandable.
We're talking with Professor Arthur Sear, who is the director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business, which is based at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's been down here in Northwest Indiana speaking to the Trade Alliance of Northwest Indiana recently, and we have him back on to talk about politics and how that all fits in together with the globalization of the world economy. And one
thing, thank you very much for mentioning our Clawson Center. In many ways, the economy here in southeast Wisconsin is very similar to Northwest Indiana. A.W. Clawson, Tom Clawson, is our graduate from quite a while ago, who after service in the Army Air Corps in World War II went on to work at and then run Bank of America twice, and in between he was head of the World Bank in Washington. So a very consequential executive, and his career, among other things, involved spearheading the international banking dimension of an earlier Bank of America, and he kind of personifies not only public service to me, but also the unavoidable reality of globalization and international business.
And I would imagine Professor Clawson would have some very strong opinions, too, about some of the topics that that we've mentioned so far and we have coming up. I know in particular he probably would have some definite views about NAFTA, and we know that the Trump administration is backing away from that, and hopefully our fellow countries, Canada as well as Mexico, are doing their best to try to persuade him not to.
I think that's a very fair statement, and I think Americans should all be happy that our allies on both sides of the border, especially the Canadians, have shown great patience in dealing with a rather turbulent American political environment currently. Mm-hmm. We're very fortunate to have them north of the border, and we're fortunate as well to have Mexico south of the border.
One of the topics, too, that we want to take advantage of while we have you on the phone, Professor Sear, is to give us your take here about, I guess, what you referred to as the Russia melodrama. And we know that's it's kind of taken a brief sidelight in the news because of other issues, but it's still out there for people to consider. In particular, it's still a problem for the Trump administration to deal with.
Well, historically, Russia has given tremendous emphasis to intelligence. And not just during the Cold War, they've traditionally had an intelligence service that was extremely effective at undercutting countries. They saw an opposition by undercutting individuals, embarrassing them, using individuals to create turmoil in a political system that just by no means applies to us. But I think that's how they've historically been viewed rightly in Europe. The British are more effective at collecting information across the board and perhaps a more subtle intelligence system, for sure. But Russian and Soviet intelligence during the Cold War was very, very effective and successful in many ways. Putin's background, as most of our listeners probably know, was in the KGB, the Russian Intelligence Service, Soviet Intelligence Service, I beg your pardon. He cut his teeth as a KGB operative in East Germany, which was probably the most intense and thoroughgoing totalitarian dictatorship in history. The KGB, the Russian Security Service, built directly on the old Gestapo of the Nazi regime.
Right.
They didn't get rid of them. They just recruited them, I can assure you of that. So we're facing a pretty formidable situation in terms of dealing with Russia. I'm sure we're up to the situation, but we have to operate differently than we've been operating, I believe.
Okay. Also, too, we brought this up, and this has been a topic that's come up here lately as well, too, is we know now that both the House and the Senate have offered their different versions of tax reform, and I'd just like to get your take on what the conference committee is taking a look at now as it tries to meld these two different versions together into one measure that will have to come back up and once again be up for a vote here in Congress to deal with how our economic problems in turn fit in together. Not only individually with the changes that will happen in the tax codes, but I'm sure it will have a great impact on businesses across not only America, but probably I'm sure it will even affect overseas trade as well, too, I would imagine.
Well, you mentioned economic problems. Actually, our economy overall is doing extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
A serious problem that's something of concern to me is the fact that we have a rather large percentage of the population, mostly male, and not African-American primarily by any means, that has simply dropped out of not only the economy and society, like a lot of important things. That's something the media manages to completely ignore. But our economy overall is doing quite strong, quite well. I'm very sorry that and I have an op-ed on the subject this week in papers around the country. I'm very sorry that the Republicans have concentrated on relief for very high income groups, while working people are getting only a temporary tax cut. I'm glad to see tax cuts for business, but I wish the Republicans had concentrated their effort at being helpful to people beyond the highest income groups in the country, frankly. In terms of actually answering your question, I don't think the Republicans will have trouble reconciling the bills. I'm hopeful that the really harsh and mean-spirited aspects of the House bill will be eliminated in conference, but the two bills are pretty close together.
Mm-hmm. Professor Arthur Sear, thank you very much for spending some time talking with us today.
Well, thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate you getting in touch. Thank you.
Arthur Sear is the director of the A.W. Clausen for Center for World Business, which is at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's been here in Northwest Indiana, not only working in the past in the Chicagoland area, but also he's also been a speaker at a recent meeting at the Northwest Indiana Trade Alliance. Jerry Ross is a Crown Point native who's led an interesting life so far. He's a former astronaut who's now an author. He's written two companion books that he signed at a recent weekend event in Indianapolis. The interesting thing about your book is that you give us a great insight into the space shuttle program, and you also talk to, and it's interesting how you've been able to meld your life, your interest since childhood about wanting to go into space, with your personal faith. Tell us how you kind of linked all this together into the book.
Well, I was fortunate to have a very strong family life. My parents were both Christians, and they brought me up in the Christian faith. And I don't think I would have ever had the chances to do what I did if I hadn't had that faith and support from the parents. I personally believe that God made me to be an astronaut. He intended for me to do that. From a very early age, when a lot of kids are thinking about wanting to be a fireman or a baseball player or something else, space flight captivated my imagination, and my mother helped me make scrapbooks about flying in space years before the first satellites were actually launched into space. And doing those scrapbooks, I learned a lot. I knew there was engineers and scientists that were doing that exciting work very early on in our space program.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that many of them had graduated from Purdue University. And so I was in the fourth grade when those first satellites were actually launched into space. And decided then and there in the fourth grade that I was going to go to Purdue University, become an engineer, and somehow get involved in our country's space program. Then as my education progressed and our space program expanded and we started flying people in space, eventually I thought that, well, if I'm going to be in a space program, the best place to be is on the pointy end of the rocket. And so I adjusted my goals, and eventually, through several false starts or bad turns or whatever, I eventually got to where I wanted to be.
Now, when you're doing your astronaut training and your other experiences there with NASA, you obviously came in contact with the other astronauts, people like Neil Armstrong in particular, who obviously must have had the same thoughts as a child that you had about wanting to go into space.
Yeah, I think Neil and Gus Grissom and that era of astronauts were even more removed from the space program initially, because there weren't even any thoughts about launching rockets into space when they were youngsters.
Yeah.
I think most of that era of astronauts were more of the flyer involvement. They want to be pilots. They want to fly planes.
Yeah, I guess a lot of them were they were test pilots in the Air Force or test pilots in private business and supposed to, I guess, yeah. When you talk about in the book here about your faith, and you talk about this, I guess, idea that you've kind of gotten guidance from the Almighty to be involved in this, what things come to your mind, and especially the experiences that you have, all the space shuttle flights, the time that you spent on the International Space Station, what do you have a chance to take away from all of that? And thinking back, said, well, this is just another chance to get a little closer to God.
Well, actually, there was one incident on my third space shuttle flight. I was outside on the second spacewalk of that mission, and I was high above the payload bay of the space shuttle on the robotic arm and a foot restraint on the end of the robotic arm. It was nighttime, and the rest of the crew wanted to focus their attention on the other spacewalker out there, so they told me just to relax and enjoy it for a little bit. So I did. I turned off my helmet-mounted lights. I just kind of leaned back a little bit, and I was letting my eyes night adapt and to look at the universe just through a thin plexiglass helmet visor.
Right.
And as I did that, all of a sudden I had this emotion or feeling come over me that I was at unity with the universe, that I was doing exactly what God had designed me to do, to use my brain and my hands to be outside to fix satellites and to build structures in space. And it was just one of those fleeting things that comes across your mind. I wasn't thinking about it or anything else. It just happened. But it was such a strong and reassuring feeling or sense that I had done exactly what God had designed me to do.
Wow.
Sure. Well, I always look forward to having an opportunity to meet and sign books for people. The book, actually, and the children's version of it also, which is called Becoming a Spacewalker, are both written from my perspective and really trying to address my philosophy to young people. And that is that God made them for specific purposes. He gave them a unique set of likes and dislikes and talents and capabilities. And that makes them most suited for a certain type of work or involvement. And so I try to encourage them to figure out what that is or what those things are, and to figure out how they will use those in their adult life and career, and then to set goals for themselves and to study hard and to work hard to achieve those goals. And very importantly, don't give up too easily. Because throughout my book, I point out multiple times throughout my life and career where things didn't happen for me the way I expected them to the first time, and I had to back up and try a different route or do things a little bit better or a little bit harder the next time to ultimately be able to succeed and be selected as an astronaut and get a chance to fly in space.
Jerry Russ, a native of Crown Point, a former astronaut, former member of the NASA team on the space shuttle, as well as the International Space Station, and he's now the author of a book, which is entitled Spacewalker, My Journey in Space and Faith as NASA's Record-Setting Frequent Flyer. And Jerry Russ, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about the book.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
You're welcome. Goodwill Industries of Michiana is like the others of its kind across the country. It accepts and offers sale items for resale after checking them out and in some cases reconditioning them, and in turn provides direct jobs for some. But the organization is going much further than that in helping Hoosiers. I had a chance to talk recently with the Goodwill Industries of Michiana president and CBO, Debbie Cobble, about that. Here's our conversation. There are a lot of ways now that Goodwill Industries, in particular here in Michiana area, that basically can help people that, like you say, need the help to get back into the workforce, especially if they've been out for a while for whatever reason, I understand.
Right. We serve those individuals that maybe that it's a little more difficult for them to get back into the workforce. So whether it's an individual who is a senior who's been out for a while and wants to get back in, most definitely. But we also work with individuals who've had some felonies. So they may have that blemish on their record, and sometimes that can be hard to break it back into.
One of the other things that Goodwill Industries of Michiana is established across the region in all of the communities in which they're in, the latest of which is Griffith, because they've opened not only a new retail store, but they've also opened up what is called a community career center. For people that aren't familiar with these centers, tell us about that.
Sure. The best way to describe them, first of all, is they're free. So any of the services that we provide in there do not cost you anything to come in. That's why we have our stores. But it's kind of that over-the-shoulder help. If you want to find employment or need to want to upgrade your employment, we're going to work with you to help get that resume together, the interview together, make connections with employers, and then help you find that job that you're looking for.
I know that there are a couple interesting statistics that you mentioned that's important for people to know about the relationship that Goodwill Industries has with helping people find jobs. One of them in particular talks about the fact that every 38 seconds of every business day, somebody earns a job with the help of Goodwill Industries. It's very interesting that to have so many people that are involved in that.
Well, really, when you think about it, there are 162 Goodwills like ours across North America. All of us doing the same thing. We do it differently, but our goal is the same. Help folks reconnect into the workforce successfully.
I think that we see about one in particular was something that's called Ability First. What is that all about?
Sure, that works with individuals with disabilities. So for individuals who have a disability, I prefer to call limitation, and
right.
We all have them, right?
Right.
But they're having that trouble making that connection with the employer to find that job that's going to focus on what they do so well. We can work with that individual to help them make those connections and secure that job. And if it takes them a little longer to learn the job, we can actually provide a job coach at no cost to the employer to come alongside and help them learn that job.
We're talking with Debbie Coble, who's the president and CEO of Goodwill Industries of Michiana, which is based out of South Bend, but they do include all the facilities here in Northwest Indiana, including here in Lake and in Porter counties in particular. Some of the other programs I know, Debbie, that are maybe they're related to what the community career centers that are set up by Goodwill Industries do. They may not be directly related, but there's some of them in particular, a couple in particular mentioned about one that a program that is called Second Chance at Work. What is that all about?
Sure, that's all for individuals who have felonies and want to get back into the workforce and are just having that trouble making that connection with the employer to be able to get that job. And what we'll do is we'll work alongside the individual, work with the employer to help find that right job match so that person can be successful.
Mm-hmm. And there's another too, I understand, called Out of School Youth. What's that all about?
Sure, that one I love because, you know, it's from 16 to 24-year-olds. So if you're haven't gotten your high school diploma, we're going to work with you to help you, encourage you to go back and get that first and foremost because we know that that's the foundation for everything. But then we're going to work with you to help you get the training that you need to get that foot in the right direction so that as you enter into adulthood and have a family and care for yourself, you're set to go.
There's another program that the Goodwill industry doesn't run directly, but it works very closely with is another. It's called the Nurse Family Partnership.
This is another awesome program. This is all about working with first-time moms. They have to enroll before 26 weeks of pregnancy, and they're assigned a nurse. Once again, all these services are at no cost to the individual. And the nurse is going to walk alongside mom through her pregnancy and up to 2 years of age with the child to ensure that everything is just going as best can be expected. And then after the baby's born, Goodwill will come along and help mom find a job and reach self-sufficiency.
And there's another program I know, too, that's, I guess, related maybe in a way to the Second Chance at Work program. But in particular, it's dealing with group violence and intervention. There's a program, I guess, that's already set up over in South Bend, I guess, where it originated, at least for the Michiana Goodwill Industries offices. There's one that's going to be set up or is underway in Gary, too.
It is. This is actually a national movement called Different Things. Gary calls it Gary for Life. And we were privileged to be invited to come along and partner with the community. You have officers, you have the government, you have judges, you have prosecutors, all involved to send a new message to individuals who are involved in that group violence and doing the shooting and stuff. We're here to help you if you let us, but we'll stop you if you make us. So our first defense is let us help you get out of that lifestyle that's causing so much violence. Get your life together. Get moving in the right direction.
Now, how has the program in South Bend gone since it's been started?
It's gone very well. What we have seen is across the nation, we've seen an uptick in shootings this year. So South Bend is not unlike the rest of the nation. But what we're finding overall, though, is a reduction in the violence caused by gang members or groups or whatever you want to call them. And actually getting to watch individuals leave that lifestyle. And we know that for everyone who chooses a different path, not only is their life probably being saved, but with the countless other ones that they may have encountered in a negative way are saved as well.
Now, has the Gary for Life program been underway for a while?
It has been. We've been underway for at least a year or 2 years. I can't remember the exact date we started. But it is making a difference. We have individuals who are involved who are saying, yes, I want to change my life and I want to move forward.
That's great. So. Now, if anybody happens to stop by any of the community career centers, as they're called, the newest of which we mentioned, is on 45th Avenue. Yes. It's in Griffith. In fact, right on the Griffith side of 45th Avenue.
Yes.
The other side, of course, is Highland. It's kind of confusing, but the idea is you'll see the new Goodwill retail store there, and the community career center is right next door. That is where you can go in if you have questions about any of these programs, as well as finding out more about the programs that the Career Center offers?
Yes, most definitely. We're open Monday to Friday, and so just stop in and see us, and we'll be more than happy to answer any of your questions. And also, too, if I can just mention that if you don't have your high school diploma and you're 18 years old and you want to go back and get it, we can help you with that as well through our Excel centers. We have one located in Hammond. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to open our second one in Gary next year. But it works with 18 and older to go back and get that Core 40 high school diploma.
That's right. And so. The Hammond Center, by the way, is located on 165th.
It is.
In Hammond,
yes.
Right, not too far off to the west from Indianapolis Boulevard there in Hammond.
So correct. It's easy.
Debbie Coble is the president and CEO of Goodwill Industries of Michiana Incorporated, talking about the various programs that are available for folks that are interested, certainly through the community career centers. Debbie, thank you very much for being with us to talk about all these things.
Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Support counseling services for LGBTQ youth are needed here in the region, and there's an organization that is working to help meet that need. Crown Counseling is in Crown Point, and soon we'll be adding another location in Northwest Indiana in the spring of 2018. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke recently with Natalie Lukic, who is a mental health therapist and the LGBTQ program coordinator with Crown Counseling. And here's the conversation.
I understand that you spoke at the Indiana Youth Institute event, their Youth Workers Cafe that they do, about mm-hmm. current situations concerning LGBTQ youth. You want to give me a recap of what you talked about?
Well, we basically talked about best practices for working with youth in care or just in treatment. Also just best practices for everyone that people can do just to sort of promote openness and encourage people to talk with each other about topics, and then also some terminology that people might not be familiar with. Yeah, that was pretty much mostly what it was, terms and then best practices.
What are some...
Oh, and resources, I guess. I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. I understand that LGBTQ youth are, from what I've read, it says that they're more susceptible to being bullied and they are more susceptible to using alcohol or abusing alcohol and drugs. Yeah. Is that true?
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's national statistics. We've actually also done local statistics in partnership with Geminis Prevention, where they actually did a local survey in Northwest Indiana, and they found high risk was definitely for substance use, for homelessness. Suicidality we already have a really high suicide rate in Indiana. It's like the second in the country for teens. And so for these kids, the risk is twice as high. That's a low number. It's probably more like three-fourths as high for trans, particularly for the transgender population and transgender youth.
How do the two relate? I mean, why does sexuality and alcohol, I mean, how do the, does mm-hmm. one correspond with the other even?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's all related to the way that the world perceives and accepts us. So, you know, and then the way we perceive and accept ourselves. So, because if we live in a society that is saying, you know, you're not okay, then we might self-medicate or we might do anything that we can do to get through that, you know. And, so, and the homelessness is related to parents maybe not allowing children who are trans or gay or lesbian or bi or pan live at home, but also, you know, just maybe having a difficult time. Parents don't understand, so children run away or leave. Also, depression and anxiety is all related to, you know, being able to express and be who we are. And if kids aren't allowed to do that, then it's really detrimental to them and their well-being and their mental health.
And you were talking about current terms, and I'm sure, you know, there's many probably that we're not aware of regarding gender identity.
Sure.
What do you think people need to know?
I think really the most important thing with terms is just to politely and respectfully ask the person, because there's so many new terms and kids, and especially particularly with youth, they're coming up with new things all the time, or they're finding new ways of describing who they are, which is a, I think, an awesome part of the process because it's very individualized. But it also creates a little bit of confusion. So if you just ask them, hey, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean to you? What does that mean for you? I think that is key, you know, and being open to that conversation.
What are some of the terms that are out there and that we might hear that people should...
You might not know.
Yeah, that might not know.
Sure. Well, a few that come to mind are the ones that begin with the word pan, P-A-N. So that might be, so someone who is pansexual would be romantically interested in somebody who maybe is non-gender conforming, so they don't identify as male or female, or they might be transgender, or they might be a guy, or they might be a girl, or but it doesn't matter to that person. So pan pretty much means that you like everyone, regardless of what body parts or expression that you have, or you don't limit yourself, at least. Okay. Not that you're attracted to everyone, but you know what I mean. Your options are open.
Right.
And it also applies the same thing with gender. So if you're pan-gender, then you don't identify as either gender, or you might identify as, you know, somewhere in the middle, or, you know, it just leaves the options open. And then the other one, I think, is the other one that people don't typically know is cisgender, C-I-S-G-E-N-D-E-R, which is the equivalent to heterosexual, but there was no word for that. So let's say when you were born, the doctor said, it's a girl, and you said, yes, I am a girl, and you agree with that, then you're cisgender.
Okay.
That's cisgender. It's so, like the heterosexual of gender.
Oh, I see. So you're agreeing with the gender that you've been assigned.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
So with regard to the challenges, though, that LGBTQ youth face with, you know, the extra challenges that they face with how people accept them and perceive them and how they accept themselves and you know, bullying and alcohol use and all that, how does society help them?
That's an awesome question. Well, being open to talking about things is a big one. Not making assumptions. Don't assume that because a person is transgender that is a problem for them. But also don't assume that, you know, things about people's gender. So when you're talking to someone, instead of saying, you know, if you're looking at someone who looks or seems male, you say, hey, you know, who's your wife? Or are you married to, you know, who's your girlfriend? Say, who are you dating? Mm-hmm. Are you seeing anyone? You know, little things like that are more inclusive that you can do every day that don't make anyone feel uncomfortable, but they're just more inclusive, pretty much. Also saying things like, who are your parents? Instead of, who's your mom and dad? So for our kids at home that have two dads or two moms or, you know, somebody that might have a pansgender parent, you're not limiting that conversation. You're not shutting that conversation down immediately and including them in that. Providing safe spaces at school, you know, people that people can go and talk to, but also not only that. I mean, it's interesting. We were having this conversation yesterday. A lot of people think that the solution for kids at school for transgender kids is to give them a separate bathroom to use. Well, that's really othering to give them that separate bathroom. All they want to be able to do is use the bathroom. It's all about just going to the bathroom. So, yeah. You know, maybe the kids that feel uncomfortable with the transgender person using the restroom could use a separate restroom because that's not, then they're not being outed every time they go to that restroom. So, you know, little things like that. It's not that people want special treatment. They just want to live their lives and do normal stuff.
They want equal treatment.
Yes. Yep.
Is there any events coming up that educational type events around Northwest Indiana that you guys have that people can go to that I can mention?
We are planning, and you're going to have to check back with me. I'm sorry. We are planning to do an event, but we haven't set a date yet. And then we're always doing trainings about town. We're doing them often, as often as we can and in as many places as we can.
Now, Crown Counseling, I take it's probably in Crown Point, right?
Yes, okay. We are. We are opening a new office on Indianapolis Boulevard in Hammond. It has been announced on the website. If you go to the website, you can see there's actually an address. I don't know the address because we haven't opened yet. And we are having a second night. Also, I want to definitely tell you about my group. We have a group that meets here every Wednesdays at 7:30.
Mm-hmm.
And it's open, free. We have a grant, so anyone can come. It's for the LGBTQ families, youth and families. It's open to everyone. We have two facilitators, so sometimes we'll meet with just the kids with one and the adults with another during that same meeting. You don't have to sign up, then there's no cost. And we got a grant to do another night that we will be also doing in. We just don't know when the facility is going to be opened. You don't have to give your name if you don't want to. It's totally anonymous. and it meets at Crown Counseling on Wednesday nights at 7:30.
What kind of event is it? How would you describe it?
We do it every week. It's a support group. We have different topics each week. You know, towards the holidays, we'll talk about how to cope with family members that aren't supportive. We also just do things like, you know, make support chains or go around and check in with everybody. We do that every week. We'll go around and check in with everybody and just see how everybody's week is going, you know, and then we offer support to each other. This is our fourth year.
That's Natalie Lukic with Crown Counseling, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. The Department of Child Services says asphyxiation was the leading cause of child neglect deaths in fiscal year 2015, and according to DCS data, only a quarter of those incidents the result of parents failing to provide safe sleeping environments. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us, what constitutes a safe sleep environment is an issue that is being hotly debated these days among medical professionals, researchers, and parents.
Okay. You want to wear this kitty cat one?
From the moment you step into Anna and Beth Drowski Glowinski's home, it's clear they don't get much downtime.
Are you gonna wear this one or that one?
The whole family's in the living room, and Anna and Beth are trying to keep all three of their daughters entertained using a combination of plastic jewelry, a music box, and books. Anna says juggling it all keeps them on their toes.
So they each have different needs?
That's one of the reasons Anna and Beth decided to co-sleep with their kids. Their bed is right in the middle of their bedroom, with their daughters having their own beds on either side. But they can move into their parents' sleep space if they want to at any point in the night.
Like, we're not forcing our children to co-sleep with us, but if they want to come get a snuggle, or they feel scared, or they might just need a little reassurance, we can just be available to them.
Anna says it also allows her to nurse her youngest daughter, Josie, in the middle of the night without having to go into another room and sacrifice her own sleep. Oftentimes, Josie will spend the rest of the night in bed with her parents. It's a practice called bed sharing, and one that Anna and Beth researched extensively before trying. But several national organizations, including the Centers for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, and American Academy of Pediatrics, say while sleeping in the same room as an infant can be beneficial, sharing a bed with a baby can be deadly. Safe Sleep Coordinator for the Indiana State Department of Health, Holly Wood, offers the same guidance to parents.
A child needs to sleep alone, on their back, in a crib. And what that means is alone, that means absolutely nothing in their sleep environment. So no blankets, no pillows, no other humans.
The Department of Child Services says in its most recent Child Abuse and Neglect Annual Report that 17% of the cases it investigated in fiscal year 2015 were child deaths due to asphyxia. The agency says that number demonstrates an increased need for safe sleeping practices. But James McKenna, who runs the Mother and Baby Behavioral Sleep Lab at the University of Notre Dame, says blanket statements condemning bed sharing are misguided.
It's very frustrating that they use this wonderful goal we all have of reducing infant deaths in this way, and making themselves irresponsible statements about the nature of the parents who are exhibiting this behavior.
McKenna has observed hundreds of mothers and babies as part of his research over the years. He says bed sharing can be safe and even beneficial to both baby and their mothers if done under the right circumstances. McKenna's research says only babies who are breastfed should bed share with their mothers because of the special connection it establishes.
There is a biological integration of how mothers' bodies are actually responding and can respond to those babies in a safe, non-drug-using, an environment in which the mother did not smoke.
And that's another key part of McKenna's research. He says when organizations advise against bed sharing altogether, they fail to educate parents about the many factors that can make the practice unsafe. In all of the bed-sharing deaths DCS investigated in fiscal year 2015, the parents admitted to or tested positive for drugs and alcohol.
There has been this terrible failure to understand that bed-sharing is the beginning of a conversation. It isn't the end of a conversation. It is not a discrete variable. It is composed of many variables, including the nature of the relationship that the mother has with the baby brought to share.
But the State Department of Health maintains bed sharing isn't safe under any circumstances. Wood says it's just too risky.
Just being asleep next to an infant and having your arm across their chest can actually result in a sleep-related death.
That puts parents like Anna and Beth in the middle of a heated debate, trying to decide what's best for their children. They plan to keep practicing what they consider safe sleep, giving their daughters the option to make their way into their parents' bed when they need to. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
The wealth gap in America plays out in a whole lot of ways. At the low end of the income spectrum, more single-parent families. How one community is trying to change that economic equation next time on Marketplace.
Tune in at 5:30 for Marketplace here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
All the signs are pointing to the region's economy growing in 2018. Indiana University Northwest economist Micah Pollack was on Regionally Speaking to talk about the latest Northwest Indiana Coincident Economic Index. He says it shows that the local economy will grow by 2% next year, more than it has this year, but still it's rather slower growth historically than elsewhere in Indiana.
When you look a little bit deeper, while this growth is positive, it's much slower than you see both at the state and the nation. So while we've been averaging about 1.2% per year over the last 10 years, mm-hmm. the state has averaged 2.9%, and the United States has averaged 2.9%. So we're growing a little bit slower than the state and the nation. Part of the reason is when you look at what is growing in Northwest Indiana, the types of jobs and the types of income that people are getting, there's a big split between goods-producing jobs that we, our traditional manufacturing, construction, things like that, and service-providing jobs, which maybe retail sales and food service. We're seeing a lot of new jobs in food service and retail sales replace older jobs that are in manufacturing. And those two types of jobs are not really equivalent. One tends to pay a lot more and have a lot better benefits than the other.
I know that you had a chance to talk in more detail about the index, or at least the latest report, here not long ago when Chancellor Lowe was holding his Commission for Community Engagement program over at IU Northwest. Was there anything in particular that you brought out in that conversation at that event that you were kind of touching on, or were just kind of you were able to go into more detail with this group about?
So that in that presentation, we focused a little bit more on the technical details, kind of the methodology behind the index. But kind of the one takeaway that I thought was kind of surprising was that if you go back from 2012 to 2017, the number of jobs in Northwest Indiana has basically stayed stable. We've grown a little bit, but it's only a couple hundred jobs. But if you kind of look at where those jobs are being created, we've lost about 6,000 goods-producing jobs, manufacturing jobs, and those have been replaced by about 6,000 new service-providing jobs, so retail, food service, things like that. And as I mentioned, the average wage in a retail service-providing job is roughly half what you would get if you were looking at a goods-producing job.
Well, that was probably some of the best service industry jobs, I would imagine, because I know that you had in the information that the lost manufacturing jobs, had wages as high as $80,000. So we're probably talking about some of the jobs, the best jobs at the steel mills. And then you take that, and if you take that in half, it's not quite $40,000. That still has to be a pretty well-paying job in the service sector to make that much, I would think.
That's true. And so we're seeing a lot of jobs also in healthcare, which has been kind of a big boon for the region. But nationally, service-providing jobs pay a lot more than Northwest Indiana because we haven't really kind of focused too much on service-providing jobs here. We're our history, our lifeblood is in manufacturing. We tend to think about it in that way. But the types of jobs nationally that pay well and are service-providing, things like accounting, finance, computer systems, consulting, management, we haven't really given too much attention to here in Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I think, for the future, that's what we need to focus on. Replacing manufacturing jobs one at a time isn't going to kind of provide a long-term solution to our economy. We need to think more about how can we bring in those service-providing jobs that pay $80,000 or $90,000, and how do we bring those to the region?
In the past, I know we have talked about, and I'm sure it hasn't changed since the last time we talked about this, was, and you mentioned here about the fact that we need to look for higher-paying jobs, and I imagine a lot of this, too, has to fit into, we have to retain our college graduates here in Northwest Indiana. Once they graduate from IU and Purdue and all the other schools around Northwest Indiana, we have to keep them here at home, if they're living here, so that they are able to be productive parts of the workforce.
Yeah, absolutely. In order to attract these types of jobs, we need to have the type of workforce that firms are looking for. And so we need to look at why are people leaving and what can we do to keep them here. And often it's a question of quality of life. What services and amenities can we provide here in Northwest Indiana that we haven't been in a while? We have to compete directly with Chicago many times, unfortunately, and so that can be tough to do. You know, Chicago has a lot of different amenities that may be appealing to younger people and to millennials, and so when they finish their degree, they may decide to move to Chicago to pursue a career and change their living environment. And so how do we create an environment here in Northwest Indiana that is, you know, a place that somebody wants to live and somebody wants to raise their kids in?
I know that, speaking of the Chicago area being a competitor, certainly for jobs and for the quality of life that we want here in Northwest Indiana, but now we have this other issue that's just come up recently, is the interest that Amazon has wanting to find a location for its second world headquarters. And we know that Chicago's in the running. We know the city of Gary, Indiana's in the running, as Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson has gone out and done her best to try to get the attention of Jeff Bezos in out on the West Coast, telling him, hey, you should locate your HQ2 in Gary, Indiana. So we were fighting at it. We're working on it, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this push to try to attract something like Amazon, again, actually attracting Amazon is going to be kind of a long shot, but to attract something like this has really opened the eyes of a lot of people, I think, because, like I said, up until now, we've always focused on how do we bring in another, you know, manufacturing or plant or manufacturing firm. And now, when you realize that you have these high-paying service sector jobs that you could potentially be attracting here, what do we need to do to kind of lay the groundwork and make this an environment where these jobs are more likely to come in?
Now, I've talked with other people and asked them the question, so I'll pose the question to you. Do you think that Northwest Indiana stands a chance at least, if not getting the second headquarters, at least getting some economic benefit out of it, wherever it may happen to go? At least here in the Midwest, certainly.
Yeah, certainly if it goes to Chicago, we will get benefit. There are, you know, quite a few people that live in Northwest Indiana and work in Chicago, so that will be certainly helpful. But whether it's Amazon or it's the headquarters of some other major company, this is the type of thing we need to look for and try to encourage in Northwest Indiana, because this is what's growing nationally and the types of jobs that are high paying and desirable. And so those are the ones we need to bring in here and focus on.
IU Northwest economist Michael Pollack also says it's time for governmental and political leaders to set aside their territorial tendencies and come up with a unified economic plan for Northwest Indiana. A new pain medication in development at Indianapolis-based Eli Lilly and Company took another step forward recently. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the migraine drug is part of the company's non-opioid pain management platform.
The drug is called galcanezumab. It's one of three being crafted by Eli Lilly to treat chronic and serious pain. The medicine has shown promising results in a series of trials, says Lilly development leader Rob Conley.
Around 60% of our patients lost more than half their headache days, and some patients even got to 100% loss of headaches.
The treatment, a once-monthly injection, is now under review for approval by the FDA. Eric Perlman is the medical lead and says the new series of pain medication works preventatively.
By blocking that molecule or peptide, it interrupts the pathway of turning on migraine that happens in the brain.
Final FDA approval could come within a year. An estimated 13% of the U.S. population suffers from migraines. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And this final story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I was 19 when I had my son, and I just lost my mom, and we were homeless. We had nobody to help us. It's just so hard to bring a child into that kind of situation, to bring them into a homeless shelter, to have nobody to help you. I don't want him to feel that he can't depend on me. I don't want him to feel that, you know, he has to worry about things like that. I don't want him to feel that it's his fault, or even though he wasn't old enough at the time, but babies can still feel your anxiety. They can still feel your stress. And you don't want them to feel that way. You want them to feel like everything's going to be okay and they don't have to worry, because they're children. They shouldn't have to worry about where they're going to sleep at night or what they're going to eat or anything of that sort. When you have a child, that child comes first. Sometimes he eats, you don't eat. That's just the way it is. Even when you have a job, you only get paid minimum wage, and minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. And depending on how many hours you get, sometimes your checks are only $200 or $300 every 2 weeks. And that is not enough to get an apartment, to feed your child, to buy diapers, to buy clothes, to have transportation. And when you live in Portage, there's no bus transportation to get people back and forth. And most jobs won't even give you 30 or 35 hours a week. Like, the why, they wouldn't let us work over 30 hours a week. And that was only about $200, $300 every 2 weeks, depending. That's not enough to go out there, put a down payment on an apartment, and pay $600 a month. When we moved into the homeless shelter, Gabriel's Horn, in South Haven, I mean, this homeless shelter was really nice. It was awesome, to be honest with you. You had your own room, had your own little refrigerator in there. The people were really, really nice. They wanted to help you. Yes, things could be complicated, having to get along with other people that you don't know and live with these people and, you know, share the kitchen and the bathrooms and the living room. I mean, you had a curfew of 9 o'clock on the weekdays and 10 o'clock on the weekends. You're allowed to have 3 overnights a month. You could have visitors, but they couldn't go in your room, of course. Kids had to be in bed by 8 o'clock. There was mandatory counseling that you had to do, group counseling and individual counseling. You had chores that you had to do every day before you left the house. If you didn't come in on time, they would lock you out. And after so many write-ups, they would have to put you out. I think it was 5 or 6 write-ups that they would say that, you know, it's time for you to go. They helped with transportation. The house mother, when we moved out, she took Jaden to school for 2 years back and forth and took me to work because I did not have a car. And for 2 years, she still helped us every single day. She would come from South Haven by his school all the way to Portage, pick us up, take us all the way back to South Haven, and take me all the way back to Portage. Every day for 2 years, she did that. So they were really nice people. They had us fill out an application for housing opportunities. And then we were on the waiting list for about 5 or 6 months before we got our apartment. Hanging up pictures on the walls and hanging up his crafts from school and decorating his room and making his room feel like it was his own was probably one of the best memories because he was really excited when we started putting stuff into place and it became his own room with all his toys and his pictures that he made. And was able to have friends come over and spend the night and play with his stuff. I think being a mom is amazing. Like, you never know how much you can love somebody until you have a child. There's no love like it. Like, sometimes you love them so much that you just cry. There's no love like having a child. You don't feel that way about anybody else. That is truly unconditional love. There's nothing like it.
You can find more regional stories online on the Welcome Project website, welcomeproject.valpo.edu. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.